This is Stellacast, episode 9. Hello, everybody. Stellacast, found online at stellacolony.com. What's up there, Alex?
Hi.
Are you having a seizure? Or are you just dancing again? Oh, wait, what's that?
So this music is just really corny.
Yeah, I know.
Hi, Ben.
Hi.
Hi, Ben.
No one cares about you.
No, it does.
I'm the fun one.
To say the very least.
I'm
the boring guy.
I'd love to open up the, with some real music, like some Tool or something, but I just don't want to get sued.
I was thinking about that too. Like, if you can't use any sort of music from anybody else.
No, I mean, I can do like a license through RIAA, which is like the Recording Industry Association or something. Doesn't matter. But it, in that way, that's how, music stations will be able to play whatever songs they want. I don't think it's feasible really. Cause I looked into it once, and actually it's not super expensive, but the tracking is like a hassle. Like, you have to track like all your downloads and plays and like every single time that song was played in one of your podcast episodes. And anyways,
it's not worth it.
No, it seems
public
like
domain music.
This is not public domain music.
But it sounds like it. But here's public domain music. You could play, like, Do Your Ears Hang Low and shit like that.
Or something like this.
Ring, 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 ring.
Stop.
Banana phone. Ring, 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 ring. Banana phone.
I hope you get this stuck in your head, Alex.
No more.
For us to get together and
sing.
Ring, 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 ring. Banana phone.
I hate you.
Wait, the best part's coming up.
Banana phone. It grows in bunches. I've got my hunches. It's the best. Beats the rest. Cellular, modular, interactive, modular. Ring, 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 ring.
That's enough.
I sure hope that gets stuck in your head, Alex. I'm going to hear that for the next 3 weeks. Sorry, guys.
Why did you just have that on hand?
Where did you just...
You son of a bitch.
I have a whole soundboard in front of me. I just never use it. So...
Let's keep it that way.
Oh, I love that. Boop, 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 boop. Okay.
You son of a bitch.
Stellacast, got some stuff on the forums here. Hey, we're going to start with Striking Twice, who's a Stella Culinary OG. He goes back to the free culinary school days, and he kicks it off with three unrelated questions. He says, here are some things I've been noodling around with and wanted to strike up a conversation on.
Noodle.
Well, the first one is noodle related. It is freezing raviolis. I have a hard time with my fresh ravs. The classic problem, of course, being the doubled up corner of the dough. That's where like the corner curls when you boil it.
Oh.
And that just happens in general. But also a lot of breakage from when I drop them. I usually freeze then on a sheet pan, uncooked, and don't thaw before I drop in. I'm at the recommended thickness for the ravioli for my pasta roller. We had issues with this in the past. Remember when we were doing the salmon raviolis? And I reformulated a pasta dough that was actually pretty sturdy, because our standard pasta dough didn't work very well for the raviolis not breaking. So you'd have to, I forget what it was. Ben, do you remember offhand what our pasta dough recipe was?
I don't.
I think I can pull it up. Do you have any tips for Dave about his ravioli splitting on him? And I think it's more so the fresh ravioli. First of all, you want to make sure when you're... The biggest mistake that I see with amateurs making raviolis, not that Dave's an amateur, but the uninitiated making raviolis, is leaving the air pockets in the ravioli itself. And the best way to negate those air pockets is you need to use the flip side of a ring mold, like a dough cutter ring, and you press down very gently around the filling, and that should press out all of the air in the filling. And if you see air pockets, you're going to have issues because that air is going to expand when you drop it into the boiling water, and that's going to be what breaks your raviolis nine times out of ten, besides the dough.
I just had this thought. If he's IQFing them, then...
Instant quick frozen.
What about parboiling them to set the starch before freezing them? Because he's having issues with them breaking. You think that would work?
Yeah, I mean, it's not a bad idea. We've frozen them in the past fresh, and they worked fine.
Yeah, right? Yeah, we have. We used to take those salmon raviolis and freeze them, and, use them the week of or whatnot, but they worked fine. I think the two things, besides air pockets that break raviolis... one is you just really got to be conscious with a fresh ravioli. You really have to be conscious of the cooking time. Like when it's done. And when it's overdone, it's going to rip. You can do an initial stir, in order to break up if you're doing multiple raviolis, but don't mess with them because, one wooden spoon hitting a weak ravioli, you're definitely going to get, a burst.
Yeah. And, I just actually pulled up in our private recipe document the ravioli dough. So we used 40% double-aught pasta flour and 60% AP flour. And the AP adds some sturdiness to the double-aught, which would lead to less ripping. It would also make it, instead of using bread flour, which would make it too sturdy, the gluten with the bread flour would get too stiff, and it would stretch and possibly even tear. So 40% double pasta flour, 60% AP flour, and 66% whole eggs. And so the actual ingredient measurement for a standard recipe is 102 grams of pasta flour, 153 grams of AP flour, and 170 grams of eggs. And I'll put that in the show notes to this episode, stellaculinary.com/stellacast9. And then obviously too, and Dave, I know he's watched my pasta making video in the past, so he's probably not making this mistake, but a lot of people, they don't roll their pasta enough before they actually thin it out. So once you form your dough, you want to make sure you go through a hydration step where you're actually letting the dough rest for at least 30 minutes before you attempt to roll it out. And then you need to knead the dough and develop gluten by rolling it through the rollers multiple times. And you're looking at about 10 to 15 passes before you then start dialing down the roller to sheet the pasta into thinner sheets. So you take your hydrated dough and you just roll it through your thickest setting, fold it back on itself, and then roll it through again. And then continue that for 10 to 15 times. And I have a video on that I'll post in the show notes. But really, I think, Dave, if you use the formulation that I gave you, you're going to have a lot better luck. And also, too, you want to make sure that you're sealing your raviolis with water and not egg. A lot of people, for some reason, they seal their raviolis with egg, and that always just leads to a mess. You tend to get more air pockets as the egg whites expand in between the sheets of dough. And you don't get as tight of a seal when you're using eggs. So just brush your dough very lightly with water. You can just use your fingertip that you dip in some cold water, and that's going to seal it. But between the pasta dough formulation that I gave you, which is made specifically for raviolis, and then rolling it out properly with kneading it first, and then using a ring mold to press all the air out of your filling. So as you lay that second sheet of pasta across the top, your filling is then going to bulge up through that pasta, and you're going to then take a ring mold and very gently, without tearing the pasta, work that ring mold down around the filling. And the ring mold should be just big enough to where it scrapes the sides of the filling on all sides. And that's going to help to round your filling. It's going to help to cinch or crease the top sheet of pasta to the lower sheet. And you can then press out with your finger all the air pockets around the dough. And I like the wheel ravioli cutters too, because they're really quick, and that it's when you use the wheel to cut raviolis, and they're like $5 on Amazon. I'll put a link to one. It crimps the edges as you go as well, and when you crimp the edges, it's less likely for air to seep back in. So you can use a fork, like the backside of a fork as well. But you're gonna have to cut your raviolis regardless. So if you don't mind them being like a square shape, which I kind of like, because it makes them look rustic and handmade, then use a ravioli cutter, and that's this little that cutting wheel, and that's going to help them hold their crimp during the cooking process. What other issues were we having with raviolis? That was pretty much it, right? And so,
yeah, once we got that dough down, it was fine. I mean, I'd have one burst out of 100. You know, we're doing pretty well on that.
And that's just going to happen, too. They're going to burst on you. It's like, no matter how good at making raviolis you are,
it'll just be a weak spot in the dough, or, yeah, you know, hits the side of the pot the wrong way, or, you know, whatever.
Yeah, and sometimes you'll break the dough when you're actually forming the raviolis, too. And it won't always be noticeable. So you just got to notice when that dough breakage occurs. And just redo that ravioli. Remove the filling. And just go to a cleaner sheet of pasta that hasn't been broken yet. And that can get frustrating, especially if you're using the wrong dough formulation. But the dough formulation that I gave you is something that, we tested over the course of a few months. I was trying different combinations of flour because I was having a lot of issues with the dough breaking on me when I was actually forming the ravioli, and then definitely when we were cooking them. And having raviolis break on you in the middle of dinner service is not a fun thing to deal with.
No, but this dough is solid.
Yeah, for sure. The next thing Dave wants to discuss is candied nuts. I think this is just my sugar coating or sugar cooking shortcomings, but I have a hard time getting them to be how I want. I toast the nuts, pecans in this case, and then I throw in some brown sugar with 5-spice powder. The sugar doesn't seem to be breaking up. So I do a little bit of water in it just to get the sugar swirlable. The nuts are delicious, but they're a little soft. Is that how the pecans just are? How can I get that shellac? I guess crunchy? How can I get that shellac quality? Oh, I think he meant to be shell-like, but it was like an auto response or something. How can I get that shell-like quality to my candied nuts? Alex, you're a candy nut aficionado. Where's Dave going wrong?
Well, you got to make a slurry.
Right.
I've never used brown sugar. I don't see why it wouldn't work, though.
But it sounds like he's not baking after he adds the sugar.
Oh, what?
That's what it sounds like. He says, okay, so I toast the nuts, and then I throw in some brown sugar with my 5-spice powder.
Oh, we just got to take them.
So
the whole process.
Though. Yeah.
Well, that doesn't make any sense.
Well, let's just tell them from A to B how we do it.
Oh, so you just like mix your sugar with water just to get it nice and syrupy. Then you toss your nuts and spices. Actually,
spice raw nuts, not toasted already.
Well,
I mean, I guess you can do toasted, but
it's not like cashews wouldn't suck if they were already toasted. But like. Spice powder actually sounds good.
Mm-hmm.
Toss them in that, then bake them on a silk pat, unless you hate your self.
Yeah, silicon mat is important. And our standard mix that works really well for us, and I've shot a video on this candying nuts, but I'm so far behind on all the video editing. But it's real easy. And what we'll do is our standard sugar is powdered sugar for candying nuts, just because it's really easy to work that into a slurry. Not so much with like granulated sugar. So if you're using brown sugar or granulated sugar, then you can work into a slurry with some heat. So you're going to have to dissolve it first with a little bit of water and some heat in a pot, and then toss your nuts with that. But what we'll do is we'll just take some powdered sugar, add just enough water to thin it out into a slurry that will coat the nuts lightly. And sometimes I'll use a mixture of water and lemon juice because the lemon juice adds some acidity, especially if I'm using it in a savory application. So I don't want them to be overbearingly sweet. I'll add some lemon juice. It'll help cut through the sweetness of the powdered sugar. And once you have that slurry, then you can doctor it however you want. You know, you add a pinch of salt just for some added seasoning. Your five spice can go in at that time. Some cinnamon, cayenne, whatever. Actually, a little bit of cayenne is always a nice touch. Even if you add just a small amount to where your spices aren't or your nuts aren't noticeably spicy. But it can still add some complexity because that cayenne is going to help on a very subtle level in small amounts cut through the sweetness of the candy nuts. Then just coat them evenly by tossing them around in a mixing bowl using a spatula and place on a sheet tray lined with a Silpat or a silicone baking mat because it's going to get messy. And the silicone baking mat is going to help you keep your sheet tray from not getting totally just gunked in a candied nut
basically
goo.
Ruined.
Yeah. Pretty much. And then what do? We do normally we do 350 or 375?
350.
Yeah, we do 350 in the convection oven. Normally we'll set it for 5 minutes. And at 5 minutes, the sugar is pretty much melted into a syrup. And then you move it around with a spatula just to spread out the syrupy coating and then bake for about another 5 minutes until they're done.
Sometimes you'll move it around again and give it another five. Depends on how loose your slurry was.
Yeah, just work in 5 minute intervals because candy nuts can go from perfect to burnt like almost instantly.
When you smell nuts, they're done.
Yep, that's a good point.
Then there's also, I really like how the deep fryer method, it's a total pain in the ass.
Yeah.
But I really like the finished product of doing the deep fryer method.
So the deep fryer method, you blanch, at least when I did it, you blanch the nuts. Like in my case, we did pecans. Blanch for 5 minutes. You pour the hot nuts into a thicker slurry. Same kind of thing. Cayenne, powdered sugar, water, but a little bit thicker than what you do it, you know, put it in an oven. And then throw them in the fryer at 300 and fry till done, but fry probably 3-4 minutes. And they get a real nice glossy coat on them. But either method is
really crunchy.
Yeah, really crunchy. But either method is a great way to do it.
That's how we used to do it at the Big Water. At Lone Eagle, and they came out really, really good. But they absolutely destroy your fryer.
Yeah,
you want to change your oil after that.
Yeah. So and it's just
a pot with a separate pot. Don't use your
for sure. I mean, so when doing them at home. Because you can make, candy nuts last almost indefinitely if you keep it in an airtight, dry container, you know, somewhere in a cool place in your kitchen, you know, like in a cupboard that doesn't get, like, a lot of direct sunlight or heat. So you can sacrifice, you know, maybe a quart or two of oil to do a couple of batches of candy nuts that are going to last you in your home kitchen for your home use for a few months easily. But when you have them on a menu in a restaurant that does, like, 400 covers a night, you know, you're doing a lot of candy nuts just for your spinach salad sales. And it just, you know, and you're taking, I mean, what is it? How much does our fryer hold? How many gallons? Is it 10 gallons?
No, it's like, it's like seven.
Seven. Like yeah. That. So I think ours held at Big Water, our fryer probably held like 10 gallons of oil. And so you're taking 10 gallons of oil and just absolutely destroying it. You know, you have to filter it afterwards and probably toss it too, just because the sugar completely just burns and dissolves into the oil, and just it takes its life away.
Yeah, basically. So. I mean, they're both good methods, but baking's the easiest on your kitchen.
Yeah, and then you can also do like a just almost like a hard crack candy method, which takes a little bit more finesse. And that's just so you boil. I forgot off the top of my head. The temperature at which hard crack is achieved for... I know there's a pastry chef out there listening right now screaming. What the... Oh, yeah, so... This is saying hard crack is achieved at about 300 degrees Fahrenheit, which sounds about right. So what that means is that's the temperature at which you need to cook your sugar and water together, sugar and liquid together, and you're basically so you're using the liquid to dissolve the sugar, and then you're cooking that liquid back out. So obviously the boiling point of water at sea level is 212 degrees Fahrenheit. So when that liquid reaches 300 degrees Fahrenheit, you know that it's going to set at a hard candy shell. So you're looking for the my Celsius friends, you're looking at about 150 degrees Celsius. And so you make that hard crack syrup that's still hot and boiling. And be careful when you're working with this because you get that on your finger. It's going to...
Napalm.
Yeah, it's napalm. It's going to ruin your day for sure. And then you toast, and then you toss your nuts in that, and then spread the nuts directly out on a sheet tray, and then just let them cool. And by the time they cool, that hard candy shell is going to set up and give you a really hard candy coating on those nuts. So that's another method or approach that you can take. And that one is a little bit more finicky. You know, you need a good candy thermometer, but it's just another approach that's available to you. You will see that used in some pastry kitchens.
Something tells me I think that might be what he's going for with shellac.
Yeah, and if that is what you're going for, then I would say just make a sugar mixture. You could use any sugar you want. You can use brown sugar, most definitely. Melt it in some liquid, add your seasonings, and just cook it until your candy thermometer says 300 degrees Fahrenheit. Then just have your nuts waiting in a mixing bowl. Give them a good toss, being really, really careful, and then spread those nuts out on a Silpat-lined sheet tray and just let them hang out at room temperature until they fully cool. And it takes a while, too, for the nuts to for the coating to actually set up as well. So in my experience, when we do candied nuts, they'll cool to room temperature, and they still won't really have like they'll still seem kind of like soft and almost like mealy inside. And usually by the next day, just leaving them exposed to the air, they're going to be a lot better. And if you're in a moist, humid environment, you might have some issues with that in general. I'm not really sure.
We don't live in a moist, humid environment here.
No.
So, yeah. But I'd imagine just like anything, if you leave it out, it'd be a lot harder to, dry it out.
For sure. I mean, you're going to have to... You're probably going to have to transfer it to some sort of container with those, what was it, like beef jerky packet things that
silica.
Yeah, the silica packets. Yeah. I'll put that in the show notes as well. So you just do if you're in a moist environment, you want to store it in a closed container at room temperature with some silica packets. And we actually would use that a lot for some chips and stuff when I was in San Francisco, because obviously San Francisco can get pretty with the fog and stuff. And we would place them in large rectangular Tupperware containers, throw some silica packets on the bottom, and then a layer of cheesecloth. So that way the food wasn't in direct contact with the silica packets, and then just the food on top. And I never held candied nuts that way, but that's how we would hold, we did a lot of like dehydrated like fruit chips and vegetable chips for garnish. And that's how we would hold those without them getting soggy. Dave's final question was about basil jam, and he says, this wasn't a clear jelly, but a chef at a restaurant I went to before did this amazing basil jam to spread on bread before the meal. It was neon green, and the waitress said she was pretty sure they didn't set it with pectin. Any other ideas how to make a jam like that? It wasn't like basil jelly where they steeped the basil in the water and then discard the basil. This stuff was definitely pureed.
Huh.
That
sounds good.
Sounds really good. I've never heard of that, though.
My initial response to that is I think the waitress didn't know what she was talking about.
I can't think of any other possible way.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're going to want to set that with pectin.
You kind of have to.
I mean, you have gelatin, but it's not going to... Gelatin's a completely different texture. And then you have agar. Which agar is not going to give you a spreadable jelly.
None of it's neon green. There's probably a little food coloring in there.
Yeah, a little food coloring for presentation, which isn't a bad thing.
Mm-mm, not at all.
A couple of drops of green food coloring in your jelly.
Some things taste better when they're colored, right?
For sure. Yeah, like mint jelly, with your lamb. We were doing we were going all natural with our mint jelly. But that was just because that was us doing our thing.
That was amber colored.
Yeah. So my approach for this, Dave, would You're going to want to make your basil puree, just going through the process of, you know, blanching it first. That's going to help to set your basil color. And then you can puree it with just some water. I'm trying to think of any other, like, liquid base. What you could also do, too, if you have, like, a ton of basil, what might be a good way to go about it is remove all the leaves, which is going to be kind of prep intensive, but it'd be cool. So you remove all the leaves, blanch those, chop them, and then take all the basil stems and then just make a basil stem stock with that, which is going to infuse your water with the basil flavor. And then add a couple of drops of green food coloring to it to give you that neon green color. And then you want to make sure you're measuring out your pectin to the proper amount. What do we normally use? I think like 1% pectin.
Oh, I just followed the directions on the packet.
Yeah, so yeah, fair enough. Follow the directions on your packet. And for, so you need acid to help the pectin set. Traditionally, you would use, you know, like some lemon juice or some champagne vinegar, all of which would work. But I also think, too, a little bit of malic acid would work as well. And so I would most definitely add some sugar to this, too, because you kind of want, I mean, it sounds like it's a savory spread. But when you say jelly, like even like, you know, mint jelly is used for savory applications for old men who like it on their lamb. But when you eat it, it's very sweet, you know, so it can still be used in a savory application. So same thing with the basil, you know, so you make your puree and I would probably dissolve the sugar into your basil stock when you're boiling the stems. So you have your separate leaves that have already been blanched just long enough to set the color and to wilt them. And you shock them in ice water, hand chop them up, and then, or I guess if you're going to blend it, you don't really need to hand chop anyways. And then you would combine that with the sweet basil stem stock that has the sugar in it with your pectin, and then you would use the malic acid as your acid to set, because that's going to give you sort of that, I don't know, I really like the cool, like the almost like sour apple effect. That which is makes sense because malic acid comes from, I mean, you can, you know, find it in apple skins. Granny Smith apples have a lot of malic acid in it, which is what gives them that distinct sourness. But that's how I would approach it. If I was, I mean, not knowing the chef and not having tasted his basil jam, that would be my approach.
I think maybe you could use gelatin if you just use like a weak gelatin mixture of a small amount just to like hydrate your pureed basil leaves. Bunch of acid to keep it from setting it too much. I think that might work.
It could. Yeah. And for that, I'd probably start with about...
I kind of want to try.
like 0.8% gelatin by the weight of the total puree. 0.8% to 1% should do the trick. Yeah, I'm trying to think of how else you would get that texture. I'm not proud of it. I worked in a restaurant where I didn't have much control over my front of the house staff, and after having a gnocchi on the menu for about 6 months, one of my servers who'd been there for the full 6 months walks back and says, "Hey chef, what's gnocchi?"
Is there potatoes in this?
And I was like, well, first of all, it's gnocchi. And second of all, I'm very disturbed by the fact that the only reason why you haven't asked me this question before is because a customer just asked you what gnocchi is, and neither of you knew, and you had to come back and ask me. So it could have just been a situation like that where she just, you know, you'd be surprised how little some people know about certain topics in food. You know, it seems like a foreign language to some people. And then you're like, hey, does this have pectin in it? She's like, well, I don't think so. I mean, then she's thinking to herself, like, oh, shit, I don't even know what pectin is. You know, so that'd be my guess is that she doesn't really know what she was talking about. Because there's really only so many ways to get that consistency. And pectin is the best way when you're looking at doing a spreadable jam.
Yeah, the only advantage I would think over this hypothetical gelatin approach is you could have it be more savory and less sweet, because if you're doing pectin, it's gonna be sweet as fuck.
Yeah, there's Yeah, for the standard Pectin, you need sugar to help set it
a lot.
But there's there's low acyl or there's various types of Pectin. There's another kind of Pectin. I don't want to misquote. I'll put it in the show notes. There's another kind of Pectin that doesn't need a ton of sugar to set. So that could be another answer. So, but if you are looking to go a little bit more savory, and you would know best, Dave, because you tasted it. So if it tasted sweet, and it's like a sweet basil puree jam, then he was probably using Pectin. If it was tasted pretty savory and not that sweet, then my best guess would be gelatin. And my best guess for the place at which I would start testing is probably around 1% by weight. So that sounds good, though.
Yeah, I know.
It does sound really good.
Go in the kitchen.
You can do a lot of applications.
Try it. You can knock that out in like 10 minutes.
Yeah, when I was at Frederick's, we used to make this, I just called it bread sauce, and it was a bunch of basil, garlic, and a bunch of reduced balsamic that I'd blend in the blender and then just emulsify with some xanthan gum and some olive oil. And we just serve it as like a dipping sauce for the bread, and people went wild over it.
Pesto, emulsified pesto goodness.
Yeah, because it was very balsamic heavy. So was it was like, it? Yeah. Okay. It was good, though. Nice. People liked it. Holly's up next, asking about extra virgin olive oil. She says, I've had olive oil in my cupboard but never used it. I poured some over pan-fried salmon and drizzled it over the side of her... Biryani.
It's
biryani rice.
Indian rice dish.
Biryani rice. I poured some over. Okay, yeah. It made a wonderful difference, but I don't know why, as it doesn't taste good in its own. Is extra virgin olive oil healthy or unhealthy? Should you limit what you use? Anybody else drizzle extra virgin olive oil over their fish and salads?
Extra virgin olive oil is good in its own applications. It's a good finishing oil.
It has its place, but the Food Network culture likes to use it for everything.
Yes, there's no frying in it. It's definitely a finishing thing, and it's great for salads. You know, extra virgin olive oil and a nice vinegar makes a great mixed green salad.
I don't know if I heard correctly. Did she say it's been in her cabinet forever or something like that?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it could have oxidized, be bad by now, which does happen to that.
That can happen for sure. But like they, you know, like Ben and Alex were saying, you always want to make sure you're using your olive oil, especially your extra virgin olive oil, as a finishing oil. And yes, it is very healthy for you. It's considered a good fat. But the moment that you start adding heat, and even just it being in a warm spot in your kitchen for a month or two, it's going to break it down. But yeah, you see it seems like for whatever reason on cooking shows, maybe they get fat checks from like olive growers or something crazy.
Because even the guys I trust will use it in
a pan fry
situation. It's like you shouldn't be using it there.
Well, you can use what they call extra light olive oil, which has been like heavily filtered, and that has a high smoke point and doesn't have the flavor of extra virgin olive oil, and that's okay for cooking.
Okay,
but I mean at that point, I'm a big fan of neutral flavored oils for cooking, and there's this new trend, and maybe I'll write an article on it because it's totally bullshit. But people are all scared of canola oil, like it's, you know, GMO and all this other stuff that's just is coming from people who are just not educated on the subject, and I really don't want to get into it now because it'd be a very long rant.
At home, I love coconut.
I use coconut oil a lot at home because, number one, it's extremely healthy for you, and it's also has a high smoke point. And, I've been kind of on a healthy eating kick lately. And,
I've been hearing more and more about avocado oil lately, too. I've never actually used it, but it seems expensive. It could be expensive.
Well, what it is you have these, and look, I'm not a doctor, so please just don't take any of this seriously. But from my understanding, you have what's called... medium chain triglycerides, and your body metabolizes those straight into energy. So it's a good fat for an energy source, and it's very healthy for you as well. So, and that's where you have like this whole. Have you guys heard like the bulletproof coffee craze?
No.
where it's like you add fat to your coffee and
I learned that one from my grandma.
You stir butter into it.
I put a little bit of butter and salt in my coffee.
Yeah, so they'll add like butter or coconut oil or even they have like pure MCT oil, which is just, you know, the medium chain triglycerides just extracted from other sources. And so having that sort of fat, the medium chain triglycerides in your coffee is going to give you that added boost, but it also slows down the rate of absorption of caffeine. So I'm told that's a whole, the people who put the fat in their coffee, that's, you know, why they do it. That's what the reason they give you. And so what that does, instead of giving that quick caffeine spike, especially if you're drinking it in the morning, like on an empty stomach, you get that quick spike and then you get that crash. Adding some fat to it slows the absorption and the digestion of the caffeine, so you get a steady, even caffeine release over time. So that's kind of like those new trends where you, and I've done it. I've played with it. I don't know. I mean, stirring in a little bit of coconut oil into coffee is just good, you know. And it's way better than adding, you know, cream or sugar to your coffee. So,
we got pretty off topic there.
Yeah.
So who cares, man? We're talking food.
I got one thing with extra virgin olive oil and salad.
What's that?
It's good if you do it by itself, you know, extra virgin olive oil and nice vinegar. So when I was first getting into this industry, I thought extra virgin olive oil was the best thing ever invented. So I went to make an emulsified balsamic dressing and I was like, oh, well, this is the best oil my mom has in her kitchen. So I put this really nice, you know, drizzle it in, and, you know, the blender, make an emulsified dressing out of it. It tasted like grassy shit.
Yep.
And don't ever emulsify a dressing, at least like that, with extra virgin olive oil, because that's all you're going to taste.
I'll put a splash of it and then use a neutral oil.
Yeah, you can put a splash of it, definitely. But, I mean, putting 2 cups of emulsified oil into a dressing, extra virgin olive oil into a dressing.
Well, not only is it powerful, which is one of the rubs that I have with people using olive oil, especially for, like, just default cooking applications. First of all, the olive oil breaks down during the cooking process, so it gives you an off flavor. Second of all, it makes everything that you cook taste like olive oil, which you want to have control of that. Some things you want to taste like olive oils, other you don't. The things that you do want to taste like olive oil, just add a drizzle of olive oil right before serving. A good extra virgin olive oil, just a little drizzle over the top, because that's going to be the purest, truest essence of the olive oil, is when it's served at room temperature as a finishing oil. But also, too, olive oil will oxidize very, very rapidly when shearing power is applied. So when you're putting it in a food processor or you're putting it in a blender and you have that whirring blade going around and around and around, it actually causes the olive oil to oxidize. And when it oxidizes, it breaks down, and the flavor, it'll become bitter and almost taste rancid. And so anyone who, like Ben or like me, I'm sure maybe Alex has done it too, who's tried to make an emulsified sauce that was completely emulsified with extra virgin olive oil, you get to the end and it's bitter and strong and grassy. Like, what the hell's going on here?
But yeah, I think it just sounds like her oil is just old, bad. Like, I was spoiled. I had the advantage of growing up like a half a mile from like a really large olive oil producer in Northern California, Shabika's, and they make really good products. So we'd go there often. We'd go through a lot of olive oil, and they make really good products. Actually,
olive oil is like wine, though, too. Like, sometimes you can just get a batch that's oxidized.
Yeah,
you know,
that's definitely happened.
You can get a bottle that's just gone bad, and if you're not that well versed in olive oil, you just think like, oh well, either this is how olive oil tastes, or this brand sucks.
Just recently, I bought that one bottle. It was like, it was like a $30 bottle of olive oil, and it was awful.
Bitter, grassy, bleh.
Yeah, Alex brought it into our kitchen, and our initial response was, this olive oil sucks. But then we started thinking about it. We're like, you know what? Like, we should probably buy this bottle again, because there's no way that this olive oil could cost this much and taste that shitty. So I kind of gave him a bit of a benefit of the doubt, because, you know, just like, you can buy a $400 bottle of Cabernet that's been corked. You can buy olive oil that's been oxidized or stored wrong. It's funny, we had a couple instances in the restaurant where people would bring in like these really nice old bottles of wine, and they'd be corked, and they would refuse to admit it, and they were just sitting there like drinking corked wine like all night long.
Awful wine.
It was disgusting.
And then they'd send a glass up.
On one occasion, they actually sent a glass back to you to taste it and try and guess what it is. As he wanted you to guess what it was. Like, it's
Corked?
Corked red wine.
Yeah, that, because it always puts you in an awkward situation. I mean, I've had that happen a few times, and, you know, people, they'll be very kind, and they'll send back the wine to taste, and, you know, some people just don't, they haven't been around wine enough to understand that the wine is corked, and even if it is, even if they do, or they aren't able to pull it out, you have so much, like, emotion and anxiety, like, built up in this bottle of wine that you've spent, like, a couple $100 on, and you've had in your wine cellar for a few years, and you're waiting for a special occasion, and you bring it out on that special occasion, you're all excited to open it up, and you just, you refuse to believe that it's corked, but it is. You know?
Yeah, I've had a couple times in my career, too, where, you know, really, you know, generous person will walk up, and, you know, this is the wine I made last year, you know, a bottle, you know, hey, let me pour you a glass, and you just have to fake it.
Uh-huh.
It's just not good, you know. I'm glad they put the effort into it, but it just wasn't good.
What do you think of my homemade wine? It sounds like a fun hobby. But then you have people who are good at it, you know? So you never know.
Yeah. One thing else I wanted to say to her too is if you're into extra virgin olive oil, definitely taste different varieties because there's a whole gamut of tastes within extra virgin olive oil. It's like beer, you know. There's Pilsner that's light and fruity, and then you got something like an, you know, IPA that's hoppy and dark and that kind of thing. And there's everything in between with olive oil as well. Just find something you'd like.
Isn't there like an olive oil tasting and like an oil and vinegar tasting room in downtown Truckee? I thought I drove past it.
Is there?
I think so. I think it might be newish.
Is it? It can't just be olive oil and vinegars.
No,
I think they have wine too or something. But
okay,
yeah, it's on that. It's on the opposite side, like, of kind the
by,
strip,
kind of by Marty's.
Okay, I didn't see it. We'll have to go check it out.
I've seen it, never.
And that's never been to it. That's fun too. I mean, if you can go, like, you know, a lot of times, if you find like a gourmet market or winery specialty shops, they'll do olive oil tastings, and that's the best way to find your bearings. Just figure out a way to, or just, you know, get a couple of your geeky food friends together and get, you know, buy some good bread. Nothing that's too flavorful. So get like a, you know, like some baguettes or something that's not going to overpower the olive oil, and you know, just line them up and do a blind tasting with, you know, four or five different bottles of olive oil with you and your friends. You guys can all kind of split it, and that's a good way. It's a good fun way to hang out and discuss food and pinpoint one or two olive oils that you really like. And there might be some that you're like, hey, you know, this, I mean, we, you know, we use various finishing oils all the time because not all, I mean, just because, you know, you use one over the other doesn't mean it's necessarily better than the other. It's just better in that application. So you know, if you really get into finishing oils, you might want to have a couple different kinds of olive oils on hand. You might want to have a couple different kinds of nut oils on hand, because just based upon your preferences and as you construct your dishes and your flavor profiles in that dish, you're going to want to use a different finishing oil to kind of drive home your flavor structure. Yeah?
Yep.
Now I want some biryani.
Let's make some up, Alex.
Yeah, it's really good.
I wonder if that would go good with our like Middle Eastern style lamb leg prime rib. Put the biryani underneath.
Be heavy.
I think it'd be too heavy?
Be pretty damn heavy. At least for summertime anyway.
Yeah, for sure. Good fall dish, maybe.
Yeah.
We'll have to remember that. All right. Jay Weinstein's up next. Talking dry brining.
This guy asks a lot of questions,
isn't he? Yeah, like this guy.
I recognize
he
this
does. Pointed out, okay, I think it's cool. And he's also our chicken wing, one of our chicken wing crazed guys. So he says, commercial dry brining, is there a way of ensuring equal coverage of small items like chicken wings? I'm assuming this would be difficult from a commercial perspective. Is 24 hours the norm for all meats? Would smaller items like chicken wings be less time? Or is 24 hours necessary in order to reach equilibrium? So I'm just going to cut straight to the chase. For dry brining, you're going to want to use 1% salt based upon the weight of your protein and let it sit overnight. Now, because you're using 1% salt, you're not going to have it over brine on you, because 1% salt is not ever going to make the meat too salty. Now, if you want to be quicker about it, which I do not recommend with dry brining, you can heavily salt the meat and then later rinse it, at which point if you left that heavily salted meat sit for too long, then you're going to have issues with it becoming too salty.
Or like, well, I'll do steaks at home sometimes, and I will salt the ever-loving shit out of it, and then it'll leach out a lot of that liquid, and then you just wipe that off, and the liquid that leaches out will wick off some of the stupid amounts of salt you put on it.
Do you rinse it?
No. Nope. Just like all the liquid that comes out, just wipe it off, and it'll wick off all that salt.
And you prefer that to just heavily seasoning both sides and let it hang out for an hour or two? Or preferably overnight?
Yeah. Really? Well, it depends on which cut I'm doing.
So which cut do you do that with?
Ribeye.
Because for me, like the perfect ribeye is just heavily salted on both sides, but like not like crazy amounts. Yeah. Like if you weigh your ribeye and then weigh out 1% salt based upon its weight, you're gonna have plenty of salt to very aggressively cover both sides without making that overly salty. And then I'll salt both sides of my ribeye, and then preferably you want to let it hang out for at least 6 to 8 hours in your fridge.
I think it was Kenji that actually did a side-by-side where he tested that method, like what I'm talking about versus just salt and sear, and it was really interesting, actually.
Well, I know he's a big proponent for dry brining.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I think one of the nice things about dry brining is the even diffusion if you're using a precise amount of salt. And it also, too, it dries out the surface of the protein as well. So you're going to have better browning, better crisping, especially if you use salt and a little bit of baking soda mixed in with your salt. The baking soda is going to increase tenderness, and by raising the pH, it's also going to allow the food to brown much more evenly and much more rapidly.
Yeah, just doing dry baking soda is kind of my home cheater method. You know, even for 20 minutes on a pork chop, it makes a world of difference. It smells better. It crisps up better.
I did that with my pork chops the other night. I did some boneless pork chops at home.
Yeah.
And, I dust on the baking soda on both sides. Just like just think of it as a strong salt. And think of, like, the normal amount of salt that you would use to season both sides of a piece of meat. And use about half of that in baking soda. But you still want to sprinkle it evenly over the surface of the meat. And then I'll sprinkle salt across the top. I actually I'll get back to everyone on this, because I had I'm trying to eat healthier, so I had a bunch of chicken breasts, boneless skin that my wife bought. Blech. But choke it down. It's good protein, good lean protein. But last night I did the baking soda trick on both sides, and then some salt on both sides, and then I put them in Ziploc bags, and they're sitting in my fridge right now. So I'm gonna go home and cook them tonight. And see how well that works, which I think is like the true test of the baking soda sprinkle trick. But for pork chops, it works awesome.
Yeah. And you rinse it, right?
No.
You don't rinse it?
Really?
Because I rinse it. You know, I'll do it for 20, 30 minutes. You
if
know,
I'm in
pretty
a,
heavily.
Yeah, well, that's the deal. So if I'm in a hurry, then yeah, I'll rinse it.
Okay.
You know, like I'll cover the surface on both sides, and then I'll rinse it after like 20 minutes. But if I'm not in a hurry, if I have at least a couple hours to allow it to diffuse, then just a sprinkling on both sides is going to do the trick.
Okay.
So.
Yeah, I mean, you can't go wrong with the chicken breast tonight then, because a day of alkaline brine is going to be good.
Yeah, we'll see. And then Jay Weinstein asked about blanching post dry brine can remove salt from the skin. Seems like a good idea. Anybody agree, disagree?
No.
Yeah, no.
No.
I wouldn't blanch my chicken wings. I would go steam. And steam isn't going to take... I'm not a fan of people over-salting things and then rinsing or soaking. I'm just not a fan. There's plenty of chefs that do it. There's plenty of chefs that are more famous and more successful than me who do it. I've done it. I don't like it. I don't like over-brining my meat and then soaking it in cold water to leach out some of that brine. I don't like over-salting my meat and then rinsing it unless I'm curing the meat for charcuterie like pancetta. And that's a completely different application and technique. And I don't like brined chicken wings at all, period.
No, you don't.
I don't like it. And I'm a big proponent of brine. But it's just, it's not.
No one believed me. No one believed me.
You know, that's one of the ones where I had to eat crow because I told Alex that he needs to brine his chicken wings. But really what I should have told Alex is just to stop overcooking them.
Yeah, right.
You got your 1% salt. You're good.
Yeah. Yeah, 1% salt is what you want. So just weigh your proteins, add 1% salt. For chicken wings, just sprinkle a little bit into a mixing bowl with your wings, toss it around, sprinkle some more in, toss it around, sprinkle some more in, toss it around, and you're going to evenly coat it. No problem.
This guy must really like chicken wings.
Well, he works in a commercial kitchen. He wants to open up like a chicken shack.
Which is awesome. I'm glad he's asking these questions.
Yeah, for sure. So he's just trying to nail down his recipe approach. I think so for high volume without a lot of equipment, right? My approach would be steam for 10 minutes, chill overnight, fry for 3.5 minutes using jumbo wings, fry for 3.5 minutes at 309 degrees Fahrenheit. That would be my approach.
Those were damn good wings.
I think
for a high volume kitchen.
I think execution wise, if you're doing a ton of wings, you would either need to just line up your stove with perforated pans and to steam wings, or you would need a commercial steamer. And when you look at the cost of a commercial steamer, it might just be easier and more effective to just do the double blanch that Alex does and still thinks is superior to everything. Because Alex will sometimes, even though he's very knowledgeable, lie to himself because he gets nostalgic. On the wings.
They are good wings, but they're not as good as they could be.
Nah, I still think they're the best.
Really?
Really.
Over sous vide?
Yep.
Really?
Wow. But it's been way too long since we did the sous vide. I need to side-by-side those. Because we did those
sous vide kills it.
We did those months apart. We tested those months apart.
I mean, yours are good, but sous vide kills it.
Well, we'll line them all up and do a final testing. But the wings that Alex does, where he double blanches them in the fryer oil. Explain your method real quick for the people who haven't been following along.
So you dunk them in oil.
What temp?
Like 300.
300. Okay. For how long?
For like six and a half minutes.
Okay. Then what?
So they're almost cooked all the way through at this point. They're almost cooked all the way through. And then you just chill them. Just get them cold. I've never actually, like, before we started doing like this in-depth testing, I've never actually let it dry out overnight. I don't know if that really makes a difference. And in fact, I think in certain cases it might have actually dried out the meat itself. But you know, just get them cold and then go back into a really hot fryer, like 375.
For how long?
For how long? Like 3.5 minutes.
And so even though we may sit here and squabble on what the ultimate best technique and method is, we all three universally agree, I believe, on a couple of important points. First of all, whether dry brined, salted, or wet brined, we do not like those wings compared to no brine at all.
Correct.
Second of all, Alex's method for how he does his jumbo chicken wings in the fryer not only works great for a high-volume restaurant environment, but when done correctly, I would happily pay whatever the going rate is for a dozen wings, and be completely and utterly satisfied with it, instead of the massive amounts of disappointment and oftentimes rage that I feel at the dry, shitty chicken wings that are commonly served at brew pubs and other restaurants.
Where they'll just take like the little ones and then fry in the fryer and then fry them for like, just like 10 straight minutes until they're just rubber.
So I think we're agreeing with both those.
Yeah, and it's awful. And when you start talking about steaming versus par frying or confit or
at the end of the day, the differences are
very
nitpicky.
We're splitting hairs.
Yeah, I mean, that's only because we've done all these extensive tests. We're really splitting hairs on this one.
But the wings that Alex makes with his double fry method are the best wings that I've ever tasted, except for when you use Alex's sauce on my sous vide chicken wings. Then those are the best wings I've ever tasted.
True. Do we have a recipe for Alex's sauce on this?
Yep.
We do, yeah. It's standardized. Okay. Have you posted that yet in one of our threads?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. We need to post an actual...
It's also on the thingy. the when we punched in all the recipes on that one thingy. It's in there somewhere.
Okay, so I just so we'll publish an actual recipe of Alex's hot sauce, which is Frank's base, but he doctors it because Frank's is lacking. Frank's is very much lacking in the finesse department. So
it's like Frank's plus taste.
Yeah. So Alex beats it in a submission. So yeah, for dry brining, you want to use 1% salt by the way to the protein, mix it around, and then overnight is going to be best case scenario. And then you guys should check out the barbecue threads that are going on right now. I mean, I don't have much to add to it because it's just, you know, a couple of G's, just a couple of culinary gangsters just throwing down on some barbecue with their big green eggs and ceramic Komodo style cookers. They're fucking nuts, man. I love it. Shout out to Mucho Bocho. He just got a Acorn King griller. It looks like a Big Green Egg. It's just a different company.
Is it cheaper?
Yeah. I don't know. Big Green Egg is expensive as shit, man. Yeah. But he has an awesome post on brisket, which I'm going to post in the show notes that you can check out. I've been
hankering for a good brisket.
Nice.
His looks good. He also, check this out. He has the, it's the Thermacue. It's like a time temp controller. So like it'll help to control like the temperature of the smoke. I mean, his rig is looking pretty sweet.
That's cool.
Yeah, and then of course you got Wartface, who kind of, I mean, he's the man really responsible for reviving our barbecue grilling and smoking thread.
Thank you, sir.
Or section of the forum, and he posts some awesome stuff too. So he has like his reverse seared ribeye, Nina's jumping in the game, and also they've been posting Tennessee Jed, who's new to the forums, who's a cool cat as well, big time on the barbecue. He just posted pictures of doing pizza on his Big Green Egg.
Oh yeah, I have a buddy that does. That's really
yeah.
Good.
It looks good.
It looks really good. So I think when we finally post our Neapolitan pizza video series, I think these guys are really gonna dig that. And
can you get those things that hot?
Oh yeah!
I mean, look at the pizza.
Big Green Egg, you can get over up to 1,000 degrees,
nice.
According to Wartface, who's I've never worked with a Big Green Egg, but I'll take his word for it. You know, one thing they're actually discussing on the pizza thread is Mucho Bocho went to a steel guy to have him make manufacture a round steel plate that he can use as like a baking stone on his grill. I'm actually going to read his post because it's pretty good. He says, as I understand it, what makes good cooking surface comes down to the relationship between thermal mass, ability to store and release heat, and specific heat, relationship between heat and temperature change. At a given thickness, a carbon steel plate has a higher specific heat and thermal mass than a ceramic plate at the same thickness. Carbon steel also has more thermal mass at a given thickness, so it takes longer to heat or the ability to store heat energy. So basically the reason why people are using steels, and we have those baking steels that we play around with here, is even though technically they're the same temperature as a stone, so if you preheat like a pizza stone next to a baking steel in a 500 degree oven, their surface is still going to get to 500 degrees. You know, there's no way around that. But the heat transfer is much faster with steel. So it's a good hack for a home oven. But what Wartface is telling them is hey, that might not be necessary because you can get your Big Green Egg or your Komodo style cooker up to 1,000 degrees, which is way too hot for a Neapolitan pizza anyways, you know, with a stone. So my initial bet, and I don't know, I mean, you're going to have to do some testing. I'm going to follow along on the forum thread because I'm interested too.
Yeah, really.
But my initial bet would be I would prefer to run my ceramic cooker, theoretically, if I had one, my first test I think would work out best, would be the ceramic cooker with a round pizza stone at around 800 degrees Fahrenheit. And that's assuming that I want to recreate a Neapolitan style pizza like we do in our wood fire oven. I think at 800 degrees, the baking steel would release too much energy into the bottom crust, which would cause it to burn or crisp too quickly. So then you can say, well, we're going to drop the temperatures to say 650, and do the exact same thing, at which point I believe the baking steel would work. A lot of the complex flavors that come from a Neapolitan pizza is the fact that you cook it in a really, really hot wood fire oven, or at least on a stone or a hot environment, and it needs to cook in under 90 seconds. That's how you get that true authentic taste.
I'd like to throw a DiGiorno on an 800 or 800 degree baking steel.
Oh, it's not going to happen.
I know.
Because they use the wrong flour.
Exactly. It'd just be incinerated.
Well, yeah. So, I mean, when I first started playing around with Neapolitan pizza, I had no idea what I was doing. And the recipe that was first handed over to me was supposedly a Neapolitan pizza dough that used bread flour and olive oil, both of which are big no-nos. Because you need the double lot pizza flour for when that leoparding, when the black char marks that you get on a Neapolitan pizza. If you use pizza flour or all purpose flour, it tastes bitter and burnt. But if you use a finely milled flour like double lot pizza flour, and I use Caputo, then it tastes a lot better. Those black leoparding marks taste like char and smoke. So if you took a DiGiorno and just threw it on a 800 degree baking steel,
it wouldn't work. It would be pretty funny though.
No. Well, I mean, we got our
to a black block of nothing. A
couple weeks ago, we got that wood fire oven up so hot that when we were doing our Neapolitan pizza testing, or not testing, we were shooting our videos on it, and it was like the hottest week of the summer, and we had the wood fire going all day while we were shooting other videos, half of which were bread videos that didn't turn out because my kitchen was way too hot. So my fermentation times were all off. It was an absolute disaster. And then to put the topping on the cake, it's getting late and it's ready for us to like break for the day. We'd been there for quite a long time. And I checked the deck temperature of the oven. It's like 975 degrees Fahrenheit.
Maxed out the infrared thermometer.
I'm like, oh shit. So I make a Neapolitan pizza with my overproof dough. I'm like, there's no way I can publish this video, unfortunately. And I throw it on the deck to see what happens. And it caught fire.
It instantly burst into flames.
So yes, you can get it too hot. But then the next day we were able to calm everything down and shoot a really awesome video on Neapolitan pizza, which
still haven't posted that yet,
bro.
it's a great video. So.
I'm so busy. I mean, yeah, I could use a whole army of people helping me with this digital content stuff, and the video stuff is the hardest, because no one knows where to cut the edits at. Like, you know, I have this whole dialogue going on in my head the entire time I'm shooting the video, and like points that are important, points that aren't so important, and I just can't trust anybody to cut the videos in the right place, and then to go back over and do the voiceover, and then you got to upload and tag and all the back end bullshit that just takes time. So, but we got a ton of great videos shot, and right now pizza is the priority, pizza and chicken wings. So all these psychopaths who are just obsessed with chicken wings will finally leave me alone. Just kidding, guys.
You just shut down that forum.
I know, right? I like it. I mean, but it's time. I mean, we've been discussing chicken wings for months now. We've done our testing, but I just, you know, and a lot of their questions that they ask will be answered in the testing notes, in the big epic piece of content that we do. I just haven't gotten around to posting it yet. But really, so the priority now is, you know, we're going to have a boot camp next week, which is just, that's always priority. When we do the boot camps, it just takes our full attention. But after that, it's going to be pizza, because I have all the video shot on pizza. Now I just need to do the audio podcast on pizza, which will be the Stella Culinary School podcast, our main lecture series. So we'll drop that in as episode 24, which is going to finish off our epic bread series pretty nicely, do a quick little lesson on pizza, and get all that stuff posted, because you know, we shot and tested and perfected, quite frankly, recipes for New York, Sicilian, Neapolitan, and Chicago. And they're all banger.
They all came out really well.
So I'm going to do a massive podcast on pizza that talks about the finer points behind that. And then in the show notes of the Stella Culinary School podcast, we're then going to post all of our videos. So hopefully we'll get that done soon. And I think that's it for the forums. I think that's it for this episode. How good was that fish tasting menu we did last week?
That turned out pretty good. We're just kind of
pulling it directly out of our asses.
Kind of, you know, we had planning, but we kind of winged it. It turned out great.
For sure.
Bend over, insert hand, remove menu.
Yeah, that was pretty much our process. Well, actually,
your black garlic lemongrass sauce for the scallop was freaking out. It was probably one of the best
that things came to out go awesome. With the
scallop I've ever put in my mouth.
And if you look, I believe it was, so episode 7 was us actually planning that menu live on air.
Which is kind of boring.
Yeah, I mean, when I was a cook coming up, I would have loved to have heard that sort of shit.
That's true.
So, but, you know, for the average person out there, it's not going to be for them. But, you know, so skip over it.
Yeah.
And, I mean, the whole purpose of StellaCast is to, you know, have a discussion that revolves around food and revolves around our lives as they are, you know, working within the food industry. And, you know, a big part of what we do on a daily basis is menu planning and then talking about dishes that we would love to be able to do, but we're not sure if we can execute them for this style of menu or this style of event, whether we're doing a wedding or doing a sold-out dinner service or doing a pop-up menu, you know. So, and understanding all that, I mean, that's all stuff that I learned through the School of Hard Knocks by falling flat on my face and failing. You know, I wish I could have listened to, you know, some guys who knew what they were talking about and were used to pulling off multi-course tasting menus, planning their menus, and sort of the thought process that went into that when I was coming up. But as far as my mom, who cooks like once every few months, listening to that podcast and being absolutely enthralled, I don't think it's for her.
No, it's definitely elongated, but I mean, if you want a menu, multi-course menu process, there's one right there for you.
Yeah, for sure. All right, guys. Well, I hope you enjoy this episode of StellaCast. And if you have some questions, if you want to see Alex dance, you can come to a boot camp with us. Alex dances at our boot camps all the time, so that's why we charge so much for him.
And sings.
Yep. Dances and sings every night. Wednesdays are karaoke nights at the Stella Culinary Boot Camp. We sing Banana Phone and all that fun stuff. Just all food-related songs. This episode's show notes, we discussed quite a bit, so I'm going to drop a lot of links in the show notes for this episode. Go to stellaculinary.com/StellaCast9, and you'll have all the forum links that we've been talking about, discussing. If you haven't yet, sign up for our free email newsletter. As a bonus, you'll download the first section of our F-Step curriculum. F is for flavor. It talks all about how to create flavor structure and balancing flavors, flavor punches, all that good stuff. And if you have a question, either ask it on the forum or sign up for, go to AskChefJacob.com. Oh, and I ran out of music. We're done. That was very unprofessional of me. All right, later, guys. Yep.